This is the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour. I'm Anthony Scoma. Today we are a forum featuring journalist and foreign policy expert Barbara Slavin on U.S.-Iran relations and the history between the two nations. More than 40 years since the Iranian Revolution and the overthrow of the United States-backed monarchy, the political tensions between the U.S. and Iran have reached a new crisis level. The recent assassination of General Qasem Soleimani, considered Iran's second highest official, at an Iraqi airport has been called an overt act of war by the Iranian government. The political fallout has been immediate and comprehensive. Iran has said it will stop abiding by some of the agreements made in the 2015 Iran nuclear deal. Iran's defense minister promised a crushing revenge over Soleimani's death, and Iraq's parliament unanimously voted for a withdrawal of all foreign troops from the country. President Trump has maintained that the airstrike was meant to ensure peace, but the rapid deployment of thousands of U.S. troops to Iraq have given rise to fears of escalating violence and greater destabilization. While major shifts in the geopolitics of the Middle East are underway, the future of the region and the ambiguous threat of a new war have many looking for answers. Today on our program, we're airing a forum that was recorded before these latest developments, but that still provides a framework for understanding the wider context. Barbara Slavin, director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council, delves into the Trump administration's role in shifting foreign policy towards Iran, the forces that have historically shaped U.S.-Iran relations, and potential outcomes for the two countries. This forum was recorded on October 24th, 2019.
Hi, everyone. Thank you so much for coming. Forgive the voice, which is a little bit under the weather. A gift from my son, who is about your age, and a recent visit to see him. But I'm going to do my best to talk for about 20 minutes and then leave the rest of the time for questions. I started going to Iran as a journalist about 25 years ago. And I had always wanted to go. I'd written about the country from afar during their revolution 40 years ago. As was mentioned, I was an editor on the New York Times Week in Review section. And from 1978 through 1981, I must have written about Iran almost every week. There were events in the revolution that overthrew the Shah, the former monarch of Iran. And then we had the hostage crisis, which is going to mark its 40th anniversary on November 4th. That's when the Iranian revolutionary students seized the US embassy in Tehran, took the diplomats there hostage, and held them for 444 days. It's still a shocking incident, even in hindsight. And some of what led to that, those events, I think, are still, in many ways, poisoning US-Iran relations today. But I was based overseas during the 1980s. I was working for The Economist magazine in Cairo. And I was generally traveling in the Arab world. But I had colleagues who were a little bit more adventurous than me and decided they would go to Iran. And I always heard back from them that it wasn't quite the terrifying place that it was portrayed to be in US media, that the people were actually very pleasant, extremely welcoming. And that there was a great deal to see and do and understand about what is, after all, a country with a civilization that goes back thousands of years. So I had this in the back of my mind. And when I joined USA Today, I had a very adventurous editor who decided that I should do a piece on the status of women in the Muslim world. This was at the point where the Taliban had just consolidated power in Afghanistan. And one of the first things they did, of course, is that they forced women to stay at home. They were not allowed to go to school. They were not allowed to work. And so my editor said, why don't you do a comparative piece on status of women in the Muslim world? Obviously, Afghanistan is a rather extreme case. So I said, OK, I'll go back to Egypt, because I'd lived there for 4 years, and I could catch up with my friends there. And then I said, let me go to Iran. I've always heard about this country, always wanted to go. So I went, and I had a first trip of about a week, and it was amazing. I spent a lot of time with Iranian women who were in the forefront of their own feminist movement. It was an Islamic feminist movement. The women who were leading it were people who believed in the regime, but wanted to have more rights, more equality under that regime. And we can talk a little bit about the back and forth for women, the progress they've made, the repression that they've also experienced under the Islamic Republic. But there has been a gradual progression in terms of women's rights and equality over the last few years. So that was the start. But I was also a State Department reporter, so I was covering US foreign policy toward Iran and traveling with secretaries of state and watching as the United States tried to grapple with this very complicated country. It was almost like being a ping pong ball because I would see the policy formation in Washington, try to understand the reasons for it. And then I would go to Iran and I would see how people there were feeling about these policies, how they were reacting to it, whether they thought it was just or unjust. So it was an extraordinary process. And for really 20 years, I was able to do this back and forth, back and forth. And I thought it gave me a good perspective on the misperceptions on both sides. I would say Iranians understand us better than we understand them. That's partly because it's a smaller country. It's more vulnerable to American pressure, needless to say. They've been the object of economic sanctions for much of the last 40 years, but also because there's a diaspora of something like 1 million Iranian Americans who tend to go back and forth to visit their relatives. Iranians have always been very focused on the West in cultural terms. They've always looked toward the United States and they've looked toward Europe. And this has persisted even after the Islamic Revolution. On the American side, I'm afraid, the lack of understanding has been profound. And it's had a really serious and damaging effect on US policymaking. I would say that it's been very rare that American officials have understood the country and understood the impact of US policies on that country. I'll give you a small example. During the lead up to the US invasion of Iraq in 2003, many of us in the sort of Middle East expert community basically said, well, you know, this is going to be a big help to Iran. If you get rid of Saddam Hussein, who is a Sunni Muslim dictator, that is going to empower the Shia Muslim majority in Iraq. Now, these are the two main sects in Islam. They don't always get along very well together. They have very different points of view on a number of issues, particularly a different sort of geopolitical framework. Sunnis were always in charge. They were dominant. Shia were often minority, the underdog. So there's this identification with victims of injustice that is very, very deep within Shia culture. The US, Bush administration, said, oh, we're going to spread democracy to Iraq. We're going to make it a democratic country. We're going to have one man, one vote. Well, if you do that in a country like Iraq, you're going to get a Shia government. And if you get a Shia government, it's going to be very heavily influenced by Iran. And we have indeed seen over the last decade and more that the politicians that have risen to prominence in Iraq have been Iraqis who have strong ties to Iran, often leaders of militias that were created by the Iranians during the Iran-Iraq War of the 1980s. If at some point Iran decides that the US presence in Iraq is really not to its liking, it can put pressure on the Iraqi government and force that government to expel American troops. Now, maybe that's something our current leadership would like, but of course it would mean a very big reduction in the limited amount of influence the United States currently has in Iraq. So this is one example where the United States simply doesn't take into account Iran's role and position in the region. We had a long period where Iranians didn't want to talk to Americans, where the mere notion of direct negotiations between the US and Iran, advocating that would have gotten you thrown in prison in Iran. But that did change. It began to change after 9/11. And if you read my book, you can find out about some of the back-channel discussions that began after 9/11. The Iranians also wanted to see the end of the Taliban in Afghanistan at that time. And they actually collaborated with the United States indirectly on the military side and directly politically to set up a new government for Afghanistan after the overthrow of the Taliban. But this promising beginning didn't go anywhere. In 2002, George W. Bush gave a State of the Union speech in which he referred to a so-called axis of evil. This axis of evil consisted of Saddam Hussein's Iraq, North Korea, and Iran. Why he would want to put Iran on this list when it had just helped the United States in Afghanistan boggles the mind. And it was very embarrassing and humiliating for those Iranians who had advocated a better relationship with the United States. Eventually, the US and Iran did begin to talk again. It took a long time. The Bush administration insisted on preconditions for negotiations. Iran was discovered to have a nuclear program that was more advanced than people had known about. This was in 2002. And there was a lot of concern that Iran would be able to develop a nuclear weapon. So the Europeans, Britain, you sound as bad as me, Britain, France, and Germany got together and they began a conversation with the Iranians over the nuclear program. The United States refused to participate unless the Iranians would agree in advance that they would essentially shut down the program, that they would no longer enrich uranium, which is a potential fuel for bombs, on Iranian soil. And the Iranians refused to do this. They consistently refused to do this. At various times, they suspended enrichment, but they said that as a member of the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, they had a right to a civilian nuclear program and they had a right to enrich uranium. So these talks didn't really go anywhere under the Bush administration. But of course, they did make progress under President Obama. He came in with a very different attitude. He consulted a lot of experts in the field, including a lot of Iranian Americans. He changed the tone of the language that the US used with Iran. It was no longer axis of evil. Now he talked about Iran's great civilization, about Iran's great culture. He talked about engaging with Iran in terms of mutual respect and recognition that each country has its own interests and its own views. I mean, not exactly a novel approach for diplomacy, you would think, but it has been shockingly rare, I would have to say, in recent times in US foreign policy. So they began first back-channel talks, and then eventually these became overt. And I remember in 2013, the UN General Assembly meets every September in New York. And there was a meeting of nuclear negotiators, the so-called P5 plus one. This is Britain, France, Germany, Russia, China, United States, and Iran to talk about the nuclear program. The foreign minister of Iran, Javad Zarif, was there. The secretary of state, John Kerry, was there. So they were in the meeting together. When the multilateral meeting ended, Zarif and Kerry went off in a little side room and chatted away for 30 minutes. And after it was over, they both held press conferences about it and said what a great time they'd had. It was kind of amazing for somebody who had followed this very dysfunctional relationship for so long to see that two such senior officials could just meet and talk and maybe make progress. There were negotiations which continued in Europe for the next couple of years. And eventually in 2015, we got something called the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, the JCPOA. It's the nuclear deal. Basically, it was a trade-off. The Iranians agreed to radically reduce their stockpiles of low-enriched uranium, to put a limit on the amount of low-enriched uranium they could have and the level of it. So, for example, if you want to make a bomb, you need uranium that is enriched to at least 80% of the isotope U-235. The Iranians agreed to keep the percentage of U-235 to 3.67%. You can't make a bomb with that. They agreed to have only 300 kilograms stockpile. You need four times that amount to make one bomb. So this deal, if implemented properly, would prevent Iran from making a nuclear bomb at least until the year 2030. There are other provisions in it for intrusive inspections of Iran's facilities by the International Atomic Energy Agency. Other restrictions on some of their other infrastructure. For example, they have an underground facility called Fordo, and the U.S. was very specific that it didn't want uranium to be enriched there, because if Iran were to suddenly try to race to a bomb, this facility would be very difficult to destroy in an air attack. It's deep underground. In return for these concessions, the Iranians said, fine, you lift sanctions that you have applied that are related to the nuclear program. And the U.S. had a huge number of them. This was a period of time when the U.S. was passing sanctions, but so was the United Nations, so was the European Union. Russia and China were also observing these sanctions. And the effect on Iran was quite strong. The economy really was hit hard. And Iran, yes, was very interested in getting out from under these sanctions. So all of this came together in this agreement. In early 2016, it went into implementation. Everything was going fine. And then in November of 2016, we had our elections. And the victor was a man who had said that the Iran nuclear deal was the worst deal ever negotiated, Donald Trump. From the moment of his election, there was a chill placed on the deal. Iran kept complying with it, but all of the foreign businesses, especially the European businesses, that were looking forward to going back into Iran, investing in Iran, basically they all got cold feet and they started to pull out. So Iran wasn't seeing the benefits that it expected. But it stayed in the deal, and Trump went through the motions. He had to give a certification every 3 months that the deal was still in U.S. national security interest. And he dutifully did it, but he would always complain about it. And usually they would put out a statement that would say, yeah, we certify, but Iran is a terrible country and it does all these other terrible things. Basically, that was the format of it. Trump stayed in it. Then in May of 2018, he decided, no, he was going to get out. He fired his Secretary of State. He fired his National Security Advisor, both of whom had supported staying in the agreement. And he got himself a new National Security Advisor and a new Secretary of State who were much more hawkish on Iran. We left the deal. The Iranians waited a full year, stayed in compliance for a full year, to see if the Europeans, the other parties to the agreement, who said they were going to remain within it, to see if they could somehow compensate Iran for the economic damage that was being done by reinstated U.S. sanctions. The other parties have not been able to sufficiently compensate Iran for that. And the United States initially provided some waivers for some countries to continue to buy limited amounts of Iranian oil. But in April of this year, Secretary of State Pompeo announced that there would be no more waivers, that we were going to reduce Iran's oil exports to zero, essentially impose a total embargo on the export of oil by a country that relies on oil exports to pay its bills. There were other measures. Pompeo gave a speech in which he listed 12 demands for Iran to behave like a so-called normal nation. These demands basically required Iran to change every aspect of its foreign and national security policies. In short, capitulate. in short, not be the country that it is. Great wish list. We would all fervently hope that Iran would stop interfering in its neighbors, that Iran would stop testing ballistic missiles, that the Iranians would give up uranium enrichment, something they'd not been willing to do before. But as a real agenda for talks, frankly, very unrealistic. So what started happening 6 months ago? All of a sudden, there were incidents in the Persian Gulf. Tankers started being hit, attached with mines off the coast of the United Arab Emirates. The Iranians shot down an American drone, which they claim was in their territory. The US says it wasn't. Very expensive American drone, by the way. In September, there were attacks on Saudi Arabia's main oil installation that put offline half of Saudi oil production temporarily. At the same time, the Iranians deny that they're responsible, but everybody believes they are. At the same time, Iran began to exceed some of the limits in the nuclear deal. So they're now enriching to 4%, not 3.67%. They have more than 300 kilograms of low-enriched uranium. They've installed some new centrifuges that are more sophisticated. These are the machines that spin and enrich uranium. They're threatening more measures, and they will take them, I am sure, unless the United States agrees to some sort of sanctions relief for them. You may remember at the UN this year, President Trump was very eager for some sort of meeting with the Iranian president. There was a lot of speculation about it. The Iranians said, sure, yeah, but first you have to relieve sanctions. You don't get a meeting for free. Frankly, I don't think they were interested in such a meeting. There's never been, in the last 40 years, a meeting between a president of the Islamic Republic and a US president. So there's going to have to be an awfully good reason when the time comes for such a meeting. And after what Trump has done to Iran, I don't think the Iranians would think that he would merit such a meeting. We haven't heard much more speculation about new negotiations. In case you hadn't noticed, Washington is a little busy with some other matters these days, in the form of the impeachment inquiry and so on. I think the Iranians have decided that they're basically going to hunker down, sell however much oil they can through a variety of smuggling mechanisms that they're very good at, mingle their oil with Iraqi oil, sell it to China via Malaysia, offload it from their tankers onto other tankers in the middle of the high seas. Iranians have actually become more self-reliant as a result of all these sanctions. They're now less dependent on oil exports than they used to be. But their economy has taken a big hit. So I think they're going to hunker down. They're going to continue to present the message that if you want to talk, fine, but we need to see some sanctions relief. There's a possibility that we might see talks on an exchange of prisoners. The Iranians have some Americans in jail. We have some Iranians in jail. Iranians have said they're willing to discuss a possible swap. And they've apparently given the United States a list of 20 Iranians who are jailed in this country for violating sanctions. I don't know if the Trump administration will take them up on that. I don't have confidence that the Trump administration has a strategy for dealing with Iran. Trump pulled out of a deal that was not perfect, but that was functioning, that was preventing Iran from getting closer to a nuclear weapon, and he had nothing to replace it with. He says he wants a better deal, but he doesn't seem to have a strategy for getting there. So the best that we can hope for, I think, is that this kind of stalemate continues until our elections in 2020. When the Iranians will see who wins and decide whether they have to change their strategy to deal with new political realities in the United States. But I'll just say, as someone who has followed this country for 40 years, it has been a very depressing experience to watch us go from the reality of U.S.-Iran engagement, and not just at the official level, but on the people-to-people level. I mean, our wrestlers, their wrestlers, our volleyball players, their volleyball players. You have a wealthy Iranian-American who lives in Salt Lake City named Hasra Simnani, who helps support exchanges of wrestlers and volleyball players. It was wonderful to see. They loved coming here. Lots of students would come from Iran. You know, it's very sad to see that we've gone from that to where we are now. And it's my profound hope that we can repair the damage, that we can find a way to sit down and discuss with Iran all of our legitimate concerns and their legitimate concerns as well. It's a country that is too big, too important to ignore. 80 million people, well-educated in a pivotal part of the world, the largest, most populous country in the Middle East, in this part of the Middle East, and you can't isolate it. If you try to put Iran in a corner, Iran will find a way to make you sorry. And I think we've learned that over the years.
That's Barbara Slavin, director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. For podcasts, more local shows, and lectures, follow us on iTunes or visit the Local Shows tab at kcpw.org. And while you're there, please consider a donation to keep local programming alive on KCPW. Today we are airing a panel discussion given in October on U.S.-Iran relations. Here again is Barbara Slavin, director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council.
So that's my grand overview, and I think the best use of time would be to take your questions. So please, have I stunned you into silence? You can ask about domestic politics in Iran, anything you like.
It's January 2021. You get a telephone call at the Atlantic Council from President Huntsman asking you what he should do besides naming you as ambassador to Iran. What are the steps that you would recommend in terms particularly dealing with China and Russia?
Well, we could only hope it would be somebody like John Huntsman, who, by the way, was chairman of the Atlantic Council, where I work, for 3 or 4 years. And was phenomenal in that job, just phenomenal. Look, on day one, the U.S. can rejoin the JCPOA if it still exists. It can be done through executive orders, same way that President Trump quit it. But I would add, and I think the Iranians understand and would expect, that we would immediately start follow-on negotiations because some of the deadlines will expire rather soon. We need a follow-on negotiation that will give us assurance that Iran can't develop a nuclear weapon and that may address some other concerns that we have about regional instability. In return, we're going to have to talk about ways to do sanctions relief that are more durable than what was in the JCPOA. I think one alternative is to have Congress pass by simple majorities legislation that revokes certain key sanctions legislation, especially sanctions legislation that prevents most banks in the world from dealing with Iranian banks because they're afraid they'll get cut out of the U.S. market. Right now, this is the biggest single problem facing Iran, and it's causing tremendous problems for things like humanitarian transactions, which are not supposed to be sanctioned. But Iranians can't get cancer medication now. They can't get the ingredients for medicine that they produce domestically because the European and Asian companies that produce these things cannot find a way to get paid for selling them. Iran has the money, but no one will touch their banks. The last sanctions U.S. imposed were on the Iranian Central Bank, connecting it to terrorism, which makes it even more difficult now for the central bank of Iran to use its hard currency revenues to purchase things like cancer medication. So I would seek congressional action, not a treaty that requires two-thirds ratification, but just simple majorities for certain specific items that we would identify with the Iranians in return for them promising steps that would mean they could really never get a nuclear weapon. I think that would be fair. I would also work with the Europeans, the Russians, Chinese, who were part of the original negotiations, and bring them all back into the picture to put this on a firmer footing. You flatter me saying I could be ambassador there. We have no diplomatic relations with Iran. So another thing I would do is I would ask the Iranians to let the US open an interest section in Tehran that would be staffed by American diplomats. And that could do things like process visas for Iranians who want to travel to the United States, to visit their family, to go to school. It's almost not worth it now because we're hardly processing any Iranian visas. But a new administration, I hope, would get rid of the stupid Muslim ban, the travel ban, every iteration of it. I mean, it was already very hard to get a visa to come here if you were Iranian. We didn't need to add extra layers like this. So those are some of the steps that I would take.
Historically, the US dollar has been used in exchange for oil across the world. And because of the situation with Iran and other oil-producing countries with whom we may not have the best of relations, from what I've heard, there are a lot of the exchanges for oil for currency actually happens in other currencies. I'm not exactly sure what, but possibly even gold.
Sure.
So do you see a more immediate future for the US dollar as a currency to actually get hugely devalued as a result of that and other issues?
It's an interesting question. You know, a lot of us have been warning about the overuse of sanctions. The Trump administration doesn't want to go to war with anybody, so it puts sanctions. You name the country, they sanction it. That's the all-purpose answer to everything. And the United States has a lot of power because the dollar is the dominant reserve currency in the international financial system. And so it becomes very cumbersome if you can't use the dollar. But increasingly, you see transactions in euros. You see Iran trading with other countries in their local currencies. So Chinese yuan, Indian rupees, they trade with Turkey in local currency. And I think over time, the power of sanctions could begin to diminish. So when we really need them as a tool of diplomacy and national security, they won't be as strong as they were before. We're not there yet. It may take another 10 years. But countries around the world, they really resent. I mean, basically the way it works now, they are forced to abide by American foreign policy, whether they like it or not. So Europe wants to trade with Iran, and they support the JCPOA. But because Trump pulled out, they're put in a position where that's very, very difficult. So the Europeans have been trying to construct some mechanism for trade with Iran. They haven't been able to really get it off the ground yet. But eventually they will. And we may begin to see a bit of a decoupling of some of these relationships that have been built up over time.
Hi, first of all, thank you for being here. This has been so interesting. I was wondering if you could shed more light on Bush's axis of evil comment. It's such strong language, and I remember it, and I think it's both reflected and then influenced like the West's perception. And so I was just wondering if you could talk more about why you think he used that language, maybe why your comment about them supporting the takedown of the Taliban, why did he discount that? Yeah. I'd just like to hear more about it.
Yeah, sure. It was really strange. Look, the U.S. had just knocked off the Taliban, and the buildup for the war in Iraq had already begun. Everybody knew that Iraq was going to be next because Dick Cheney, I don't know how many of you have seen the movie Vice. It's a caricature, but there are elements of truth in it. Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, to some extent, Paul Wolfowitz, there were a constellation of characters who were angry that the United States had not gotten rid of Saddam in 1991 during the first Gulf War. And they were determined to use the opportunity of 9/11 to go after what they said was all terrorism of global reach. And, you know, if you're going to accomplish your objectives in anything in life, it helps to sort of have a kind of series of priorities that are fairly well defined. This was very vague. I mean, you could put a lot of countries under that rubric and a lot of organizations. So Iran is considered a state sponsor of terrorism because it supports groups like Hezbollah in Lebanon. Hezbollah doesn't think it's a terrorist group. Iran doesn't think it's a terrorist group, but we do. Other groups, Palestinian groups, Hamas, for example, that have committed acts of terrorism against civilians, no doubt about it. So I think Bush was trying to sort of build a case against all the bad guys. And he saw everything in very black and white terms. The speech came out of a process. So there were a number of people who contributed to writing it. In my book, I talk about this a little bit. Michael Gerson and David Frum were two speechwriters for George W. Bush. Between the two of them, they came up with the idea of the axis of evil. I think they were thinking of the axis of powers in World War II, you know, Japan, Italy, Germany. So they had to have three. And they had Iraq, they had North Korea. North Korea was a no-brainer, but they needed a third, and there was Iran. I asked Condoleezza Rice, who was the National Security Advisor at the time, I asked her about this later, whether she understood the impact that this language might have on people in Iran. She said it never occurred to her. In fact, she didn't even think it would make much of a ripple in this country. But that was the phrase that everyone remembered from that speech. So, words have consequences.
So I was wondering, again, you can take this several different ways, but I was wondering about the internal politics of Iran, its evolution, in the context of the U.S.-Iran relationship. It seemed like virtually everything we have done, except for a few minor steps in the right direction, virtually everything has led to a bad consequence. So if there's any hope, it's that the Iranians will themselves find a direction and that perhaps they will be more capable of managing the relationship than we will. But I was wondering, in that context, what can you say about the recent evolution of internal Iranian politics?
Yeah, quite fascinating to watch over the years. I mean, there have always been factions in the Iranian regime. Some factions that were more hostile to the West, more interested in a relationship with authoritarian states in China, Russia, and those who thought that Iran really needed at least an economic relationship with Europe and, to some extent, the United States. There have been divisions between those who would like to see more civil liberties, more privacy, more freedom of speech in the country, and those who want to see less. And we've watched, they have a system under which there is a cleric, a Shia Muslim cleric at the very top, the supreme leader, aptly named, but they have an elected president and an elected parliament. And we've seen those in elected office sometimes have a tendency in one direction or the other. When we've made the most progress with Iran has been, frankly, when we've had democratic presidents here and reformist or pragmatic presidents there. So in the late 1990s, until the axis of evil speech, under the Clinton administration, when Iran had a president named Mohammad Khatami, he made an enormous effort, both in international affairs and in domestic affairs, to try to make Iran a less ideological and prickly country. And there were some steps. I mean, under the Clinton administration, for example, we started to see these people-to-people exchanges. One of the most moving experiences I ever had was in 1998 when the USA wrestling team went to Iran for a major international competition. And it was the first time an American team, academic team, athletic team, had been in Iran since the revolution. And everybody was very nervous what kind of reception would they get. They were welcomed with open arms. I mean, you know, shopkeepers were trying to give them Persian rugs. And in the stadium, I remember they had all the flags of all the countries that were participating hanging, you know, off the ceiling. And there was an American flag. It was the first time I had seen an American flag being flown in Iran that wasn't being burned in an anti-American demonstration. It was something. And when the wrestlers won, the Americans, the crowd went nuts. I think they cheered for the Americans almost more than they did for their own team. There was one wrestler who I quote in my book. He had brought, I guess you call them singlets, the things that wrestlers wear. He brought one that was very plain, and he brought one that had American flags all over it. And after he saw the reception they got on the first day, he came back in wearing the one with the flags. It was really moving. I mean, everybody had tears in their eyes. We thought this was the beginning, you know? A lot of false dawns between us and the Iranians. Really thought that was the beginning of something. But, you know, Clinton did a few things. He let the Iranians sell carpets and caviar and here, and he allowed American companies to sell wheat and, you know, medical devices. Some Iranian parliamentarians came to the Metropolitan Museum in New York City for some event. Khatami came every year to the UN General Assembly. He would meet with large numbers of journalists and Iranian Americans and think tankers. It was a real effort, you know, for Iran to sort of demystify itself a little bit. And a lot of people started traveling to Iran. It was a period when people like me, at the time a journalist, could get visas to go to Iran fairly easily. So that was one moment. And then the other one came with Obama. And Hassan Rouhani, the current president, who is a veteran negotiator for the Iranians. He was head of their National Security Council for 17 years. So he's really steeped in foreign affairs issues. If you want to watch an interesting interview, I would recommend one that Hassan Rouhani gave to Chris Wallace of Fox News when he was here in New York for the UN General Assembly. Now, Chris Wallace is an excellent interviewer, very tough. But I got to say, Rouhani really wiped the floor with him because he knows so much about the history of the nuclear issue, of this relationship, and so on. So that was another good period. But, you know, every time we get somewhere, it falls apart. You know, after Clinton, we got George W. Bush and the Axis of Evil. After Khatami, we got a man named Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, who is most known for denying the Holocaust and being a general idiot. Very aggressive, restarted the nuclear program in a very, very forceful way. A populist, sometimes compared to a certain American political figure whose name I won't mention. Obama, Trump. Iran has presidential elections in 2021. If Trump is still our president, it's going to have an impact on who the Iranians choose. And we're likely to get somebody very, very hardline, very tough. Maybe somebody from the infamous Revolutionary Guards, which is Iran's military, which we've now called a terrorist organization for some reason, even though you don't usually call another country's military a terrorist organization. But that's what we have done. Another sanction that is going to make restoring relations complicated.
That's Barbara Slavin, director of the Future of Iran Initiative at the Atlantic Council. You're listening to the Hinckley Institute Radio Hour on KCPW. We'll be right back. In this final segment, Barbara Slavin answers questions from the audience of faculty and students.
Just wanted to say thank you for starting off by discussing the Iranian people and the beauty of the country and their culture. I grew up, have some close family friends that are Iranian, and they really, truly are spectacular, brilliant, beautiful people. And that's kind of where my thoughts have been centering on over the past year or so, looking at, well, I fundamentally disagree with the Trump administration foreign policy when it comes to military strategy, as well as their economic sanctions. Although I think there are some concrete data points to show that the Ayatollahs do profit from having destabilizing actions through the IRGC and Lebanese Hezbollah across the area and trying to consolidate their Shia crescent. Sure. But my question would be, if we can't really capitalize off of the internal politics, and I think President Obama and President Rouhani spoke a couple times on the phone. So
once.
If we don't, one time. So if we don't get that perfect political formula, I don't foresee any diplomatic favorable progression while the Ayatollahs remain in power, and we have our own political ADD here. Having said that, if we could approach this, how would you navigate and kind of broker deals when we consider the complexities of U.S.-Israeli and U.S.-Saudi relationships?
Yeah, that's a tough one. You know, I think one of the benefits of the JCPOA was that it opened a channel for further conversations with the Iranians on other issues. And look, the United States, you know, our allies in the region are Israel, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates. This has been true for a long time now. But having the deal with Iran gave the U.S. A little bit more leverage. And, you know, I would have used it to help end the war in Yemen, to try to resolve some of the problems between Iran and Saudi Arabia. Instead, what Trump did was he doubled down on support for the Saudis in particular. And that emboldened their young leader to take a series of very rash actions, including murdering a journalist who happened to be a friend of mine, so, and in a very brutal fashion. We are still the biggest power on earth. We don't have to adopt other people's agendas. We should know what our own national security interests are. Yes, we listen to our allies, we take their interests into account, but we don't take orders from them. We do what we think is right for us. So I think, you know, I wish we could roll that back in some way. In terms of Israel, we will support Israel. But, you know, Israel opposed the JCPOA, or rather Bibi Netanyahu opposed the JCPOA. Not everyone in Israel did. Much of their national security and military establishment supported it. They said, yeah, it's not perfect, but it's better than nothing. Trump doubled down on Bibi Netanyahu. So we see the results. I just don't think that they're better in terms of U.S. national interest. The past 6 months have been particularly upsetting because, you know, all these sanctions, all this bellicose rhetoric, Trump has threatened to obliterate Iran. That's what he said in a tweet. He said he would obliterate Iran. What does that mean? That means nuclear weapons, doesn't it? How else do you obliterate a country? What a threat. But when the Iranians shoot down a $150 million U.S. drone, Trump doesn't retaliate. 10 minutes before there's supposed to be some sort of, you know, measured retaliation for the shoot down of the drone, to use one of his favorite words, he chokes. And he doesn't let it go forward. Iranians look at this and they say, ah, we got this guy figured out. He's afraid. He talks a big game, but he's afraid. 6 weeks later, the Saudi oil installation gets hit by cruise missiles and drones. A risky move that, under any previous American administration that I know of, would have led to retaliation by the United States in support of its friend Saudi Arabia, to which we have sold billions of dollars worth of weapons. What happened? We blame the Iranians, didn't show the evidence. And as far as I know, maybe there's been a cyber attack here or there, but there's been no equivalent retaliation for what happened in Saudi Arabia. So it's like the worst of all possible worlds, you know? We have this maximum pressure campaign, which mostly hurts ordinary people in Iran, because I assure you the Revolutionary Guards and the Ayatollahs have their source of hard currency, well protected. So it hurts ordinary Iranians. It makes them angry at the United States when they used to rather like us. But when American allies are hit, we don't do anything. The recent experience with Syria, where the US, you know, I don't know where we are now today. Apparently we're keeping some troops, I don't know. But, you know, leaving the Kurds high and dry. How do you think that made the Israelis feel? They watched that and they said, geez, maybe we can't count on this guy either. So that's a dangerous message to send to your friends. It means that they're going to be more inclined to take matters into their own hands, maybe, as the Israelis have done frequently. And, you know, that could lead to a bigger escalation. It's the unpredictability. We don't know what he's going to do from one day to the next. We don't know what he's going to say from one day to the next. I don't think he knows from one day to the next what he's going to do. So it's an uncomfortable basis. You know, Trump says he wants a new deal with Iran, but how can they have any faith that even if they reach an agreement with him, he would follow through? His track record doesn't indicate that he does that.
As an Iranian, I just want to thank you for giving us a voice and raising awareness on this topic. And I just wanted to ask, since you've been keeping up with my country for such a long time, do you think that there will be a regime change? There's a lot of protests and there's a lot of inner conflict.
Yeah, it's so hard to predict. I mean, you know, nobody saw the revolution coming. I still am inclined to think that the change is going to be gradual. It's not going to be something sudden and violent, and it's not going to be engineered from the outside. I know lots of Iranians who are involved in efforts to undermine the regime from overseas. I think the best thing they can do is simply relay information back and forth through whatever channels that they have so that people there are well informed. But, you know, I mean, when this current supreme leader dies, that will be an opportunity perhaps not to replace him with a single individual, but maybe with a council, which would have less power. Iran has new generations rising up, very capable people who will run for office. Maybe they'll have somebody who kind of combines the philosophical softness of Mohammad Khatami with the hard power of, I don't know, pick a name. I have a lot of faith in the people of the country. I mentioned women. You know, they still face a lot of discrimination. But when the Iran nuclear deal was signed, Boeing was supposed to sell Iran 80 airplanes. Maybe it's just as well they didn't, given what we know about Boeing. But Iranians were really excited about this, and they thought there was going to be a lot of tourism back and forth. And Iran Air, the state airline, named a woman as their CEO. What a statement that was. You know, and as you know, there are many very accomplished Iranian women, engineers, doctors, lawyers, artists. So, you know, it was a real statement. And Rouhani made various promises about women in the cabinet, which he never kept. But women are in all the professions. They're a majority of university students. They have fought back against enforced veiling, so that now many women barely wear the hijab. You have a little scarf on the back of your head. It's only enforced if you make it a political statement. If you stand up on a utility box in the middle of Tehran and wave your scarf on a stick, you'll get arrested. But if you just let it slide down around your shoulders and go about your business, no, nobody's going to say a word. So I think progress will come. But it'll be regime evolution.
Hi, thanks. I really enjoyed your talk. I was lucky enough to spend some time in Iran at the University of Isfahan in 2015.
Fantastic.
Yeah, for which I'm very grateful. And the thing that I noticed the most when I was there, aside from the fact that it's a gorgeous country filled with amazing people and great food.
Yeah, great food. Let's not leave out the food.
Is just the difficulty of daily life as a result of sanctions. So specifically, of course, my mother was very concerned because she wasn't able to send me any money. I couldn't access any bank accounts. There's no Western Union.
Exactly.
The cash
no
I came with was the cash I had.
Right.
And it was very hard to communicate outside of the country as well. And I was just wondering if you could maybe talk about some potential, let's say it's 2021, some potential like concrete steps that could be taken to kind of improve the lives of everyday Iranians as a result of the current sanctions.
Yeah, well, I think the ease of financial transactions is key. For ordinary people, one of the suggestions that we made at the Atlantic Council years ago was for the U.S. Treasury Department to pick two or three Iranian private banks that would be checked to make sure they had no connections with the Revolutionary Guards or terrorists or anything like that, to make them sort of an authorized channel for exactly sending money to a student, sending money home to your parents, getting the proceeds of the sale of an apartment, things that would make life for Iranians, Iranian Americans, so much easier. Now they have to use what's known as the hawala system. So this is very expensive. You essentially give money to someone and pay a large fee, and then a money trader somewhere else gives an equivalent amount to the person you want to send it to. It's very risky. Often you don't know who you're dealing with. It's much more prone to abuse in terms of terrorism than if you have a wire transfer that everyone can monitor and see who sent it and who the recipient is and what the purpose is. But if you put Iran on any bank's transaction, they'll refuse. You know, they'll just reject it out of hand. So we really have to deal with this. It's not fair to 80 million people to punish them for the actions of you know their government. I mean, would you like to have to pay the price for everything our president does?
Maybe we are. All right. So, excuse me. Unfortunately, we are out of time. But at this moment, can we just take a moment to thank our guest for this great presentation and discussion?
This program is made possible in part by the Hinckley Institute's Wayne Owens Fund. I'm Anthony Scoma, your host and producer of this program. As always, thanks for listening.